Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking at newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, I'll be getting the latest in health and wellness news, including the rise in AI therapy, why cooking feels so calming, and if green bananas are to be avoided. Sarah Colgan spearheaded the 20 by 20 campaign, which became a national movement for gender equity in sport. She's now launched Project All Rise to bridge the gap between our education system and neurodivergence. She'll be joining me in studio. And I'll be joined by the outgoing chair of Endo Ireland, Damien Donoghue, to talk about how endometriosis is a male issue too. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I had a very thought-provoking week, as it happens. A friend of mine invited me to join her in London for a night. She had planned to go to see Annie Mack interview Katrina O'Sullivan about her new book, Hungry, and another pal had to pull out, so the hotel room had been booked and tickets were bought, so she asked if I'd like to step in. And look, I'm all for adventure, and those women, my pal Jenny and Annie and Katrina, and London for that matter. Would you say London is a lady? I'd have to say, if I had to give it a gender, not that I've ever spent any time thinking about this, I would have thought the energy there is quite masculine. But either way, I said yes. We decided to cram in as much as we could with our 24 hours, including a trip to the Tate Modern, where we discovered Tracy Emin had an exhibition on. Now, I didn't realise, but I had a preconceived notion about Tracy Emin. All I knew was the messy bed, and I somewhat scoffed at how that could be considered art. But I got schooled. In this exhibition, I got to know more about her life, why that messy bed represented where she was in life. And as with most art, it was just her heart and her soul, her story put out for people to take or leave as they see fit. There were video interviews, letters, diary extracts, and life stories of all kinds of ways that she was let down as a woman by men, by society, by the health service. And I was actually left with a much better understanding of a very vibrant, a very brilliant, hurt but resilient woman. And that seemed to be the theme for the trip, because those words could be used also to describe the very brilliant Katrina O'Sullivan. And it was an amazing conversation between her and Annie Mack about the relationship we have with food, our bodies, pleasure, success, particularly as women, and through the lens of Katrina's experience. I often think after something like this that I do feel very lucky to be a woman of this generation. There is so much more we talk about, so much we tolerate less, but we still have a way to go. And I do hope on that my chat with Damien from Endo Ireland coming up in a bit will speak to that, that these issues are an every person issue. Their impact ripples out, and we can all be part of the solution. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. But now to two more incredible women. Emer Daly has been long the bringer of the latest in health and wellness news here to Alive and Kicking, but she's decided to bring her sister into the mix. So Niamh Daly joins us also in studio for the first time. You're both very welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
And you are joined together not only by birth, but you are the yoga sisters together. You're holding lots of different events and stuff.
We are known as the Yoga Sisters at the moment. We are also on Instagram as Daily Wellbeing, but we did our yoga teacher training together and we realised we were more joined at the hip than we realised, and now we are the Yoga Sisters.
And now you're bringing the health and wellness news. So up first, we're going to talk about how millions of people are using AI for therapy. This was an article in the Irish Times recently, Niamh.
Yeah, so it's actually something really interesting that's happening at the moment. A lot of people are using AI for therapy because it's simply just there on your phone and it's free therapy, realistically, for people is how they're seeing it. There was a study done recently for mental health in the UK found that about 37% of adults are using AI like ChatGPT for well-being kind of facts and figures and also for therapy. But then there's a huge increase in that in young adults, which is about 60% are using it for therapy as well, which can be great. They can get advice there on hand for free. But then there's the other side of it where AI is designed to tell us exactly what we want to hear. So in the short term, it can give us a quick fix or anything like that. But in long term, it's not giving us the advice that we need to maybe fix problems down the line that are coming up for us. So yeah, although it's free, it's easy access, it's not a replacement tool that we want to use for therapy at the moment.
Yeah, I've had some friends who have asked ChatGPT for help, you know, wording a difficult text message, for example, mm-hmm. something like that. Great. Yes. Maybe a bit of relationship advice. But as you say, you know, if you need therapy, you really do need a therapist and to be sitting in front of a qualified human who's going to help you. But you can see why people would lean in, especially as you say, when it's free and we have such massive wait lists. So we're sort of staying on this topic with the next article, Emer, and it's around how TikTok is quite misleading when it comes to getting information on neurodivergence.
Yeah, so this story was done by the University of East Anglia. So they did a huge body of research around ADHD and autism content online. And they found that 52% of ADHD videos on TikTok were inaccurate, and 41% of autism TikToks were also inaccurate as well. So they are seeing across all platforms that around 56% on social media, which is Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, is inaccurate information. But TikTok was kind of coming out as the worst. And what they're seeing is a lot of people giving personal stories, simplified traits, and not clinical criteria for what ADHD and autism can be. So a couple of psychologists have commented on this and said that this misinformation spreads because it can be quite clickbaity. These short videos can show maybe one behavior that is linked to ADHD and saying things like, oh, if you have this, then you definitely have ADHD, which is allowing people to think that just because they have this one behavior that they have ADHD or autism. And psychologist Darren O'Reilly said that social media is one piece of the puzzle. A diagnosis is lengthy. It takes feedback. It takes a lot of one-to-one interviews and really just try and find clinically backed evidence and really look at the sources of where you're getting your information, and don't let anybody tell you that you have something without them having the correct qualifications.
Yeah, and you're so right. I've even found myself doing this. I've seen something and I'm like, is that me? Do I have social anxiety? And then I'm like, no, stop, Claire. Everyone sometimes feels a bit, you know, nervous when they walk into a full room. That doesn't necessarily have to jump all that way. But I suppose there's some people who perhaps don't catch themselves, and that is the danger. Niamh, green bananas, good or bad?
It really depends on what you are looking for from your banana. So there is different stages of the banana. If a banana is green, it's giving you good bacteria for your gut. So if that's what you're after when you're going for your banana, that is what the type of banana that you're trying to reach for. But then as the banana ripens, it actually gives different elements to what you actually need in your day. So let's say a yellow banana to kind of ripe, it actually has more sugar at that point. So this is where the banana comes in as a really good pre-workout snack.
Okay.
Or a post-workout snack for any kind of hybrid athletes that you go from a high to an automatic like low and drop in energy when you finish a race or anything like that. So this type of banana is great to come in here. And then those really ripe bananas that people often try to throw in their banana bread, this is actually the type of banana that your body can easily break down really quick, really fast. So don't throw those bananas in the bin or in your bread. Eat them as well.
Yeah, but it's good to know, because sometimes you feel really annoyed with your supermarket when you see just green bananas, but they have their purpose for
they
your gut.
They have their purpose.
Emer, we're staying on the topic of food. There was an article in the LA Times about why cooking feels calming.
Yes, I loved this story. So certified nutritionist and wellness advisor Serena Poon works with Tom Brady and Sophia Vandernes, any Modern Family fans out there. And she tells us about how cooking might calm down anxiety or help your nervous system. But this process starts well before the food that's going into your body. It starts by the process of the cooking. So being very present when you're shopping for the food, being very present when you're making the food. And it just creates a sense of routine. It slows you down and builds a lot more focus. And she says that, you know, if we're sitting down to a meal and we're on our phone or we're overthinking, replying to a few emails, you're not even giving your body a chance to slow down and relieve some of that anxiety. So just really the whole process leading up to what you're eating can benefit you so much, even a couple deep breaths beforehand. And when I first saw this story, I was like, brilliant, she's going to give me one food that can get rid of my anxiety forever. But that's not essentially what this is. If we're looking to kind of cure anxiety through food, it is about the process beforehand and it is about what's on the plate as well. So that is a nourishing meal full of healthy fats, proteins, carbs, magnesium, a bit of dark chocolate, loads of magnesium in that. So really just nourishing your body with good foods can really help during that process.
And being mindful in the type of foods you're choosing and when you're cooking. Because often I know now with the way we live modern, people can have the TV on in the background, whereas to just really cook can be calming. It's one of my favourite things to do, although I will confess most times I listen to a podcast as well. But I am really in the zone. Yeah. And if anyone dares to ask me a question, I'm not impressed. So I love now I'll be able to say, this is my mindful space.
Yeah.
Niamh, let's talk about strength training. I know you're also a qualified PT. There are new guidelines that have been released that say keep it simple for the best results.
Yeah, exactly. As a qualified PT, I completely agree with that. I think in today's day and age, gym classes and exercising is a new social event for people, which is great for getting people out and about and getting into exercise for a social setting. But sometimes we simply don't have the time to do that as well. So keeping it simple is just as good. We can use band works, we can use small dumbbells, we can do home workouts that all have the exact same benefit as going to a gym class as well. Like, we have compound muscles in our body that we want to just keep on working. And this is where repetition of the workouts and the movements come into play. So they don't need to be really fancy or anything like that. And actually, the American College of Sports Medication is also saying exactly the same thing, to just keep your workout simple, get it done, and you'll be absolutely grand.
Yeah, and I do love that because I think people get really overwhelmed and they think, I need to go to a gym.
Exactly.
I need to train for a marathon. I need to get into high rocks. And then they just never get around to it because life is busy and difficult. Whereas doing 10 squats while the kettle is boiling, every time the kettle is boiling, will actually make a difference. Now, ladies, we're out of time, but as Yoga Sisters, you are holding events. So where can people find out more and when is your next one? You just had one yesterday.
Yeah, so we did one yesterday in As One Coffee Shop over on the Keys, and it was called Flow and Frequency. So that was where we were flowing to the beat of the music. We have another one of those in June. You can find the dates and tickets on our Instagram, Daily Wellbeing. And we also do Doga with my lovely horse rescue. And we have our next Doga event also in As One on the 17th of May. You will see some dogs there at that one too.
Okay, love it. I'll have to get in for both of you, Niamh Daly, Eimear Daly, the Yoga Sisters. Thank you so much for coming on.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Damien Donoghue spent many years in the medical field working as a nurse, but really became aware of endometriosis when he and his then girlfriend faced fertility issues. He's now the chair of Endo Ireland, a volunteer-led organisation to educate and support those with endometriosis. And Damien joins me in studio now. Damien, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
We met recently at the Endo Ireland annual conference. When I heard that you were the chair, and that clearly you're a man, I think that was a really important conversation to have. Not only am I very passionate about spreading awareness about endometriosis, what I really liked that was said many times at the conference was this isn't just for people with endometriosis. This is an every person issue. And I think men should be very much part of that conversation.
Yeah. And thanks for having me on. And thanks for your support for the event. We've definitely elevated the conversation, and just out of the interest of smooth conversation, we'll stick with endo because it's accessibility of language, so that we're all talking about it, men and women, because we all have mothers. We all have somebody, you know, that in our life, because it's one in seven, there's somebody in your circle that is affected. So up until a few years ago, it wasn't on my radar. I'm a nurse by professional background. And it was only with myself and my partner's experience that I became informed. So we need to have these conversations. And that's an important part of gender balance, where men are aware of it as well. We'll talk about menstruation a little bit more openly. And so if you're talking about that, then what are the complications of menstruation, like endometriosis or polycystic ovaries or whatnot. So I think it's important we're all in this together, and there's that gender equality. It's affecting 300,000 women and yet it's probably not as well known as it should be. So I'm happy to lend my voice to that and appreciative of the support to allow that to get the attention it badly needs.
You're lending more than your voice. We'll get to the running you've done in jeans in a moment for the cause. But how did you come to be chair of Endo Ireland?
When I joined about 3.5 years ago, it was more of a smaller kind of a support group type model. So there was a membership of maybe 400 or 500 people. We're volunteers. We still are volunteers. So we had 5 or 6 committee members. And it struck me that something that was so prominent didn't have, you know, the size or the support that was needed. So I immediately was the vice chair, and the chair at the time left because as volunteers, just, and quite often people that are drawn to it are affected by it. So quite often there's a lot of churn rate where poor women are trying to make a difference because they're so passionate about it, but at the same time, they're battling a chronic disease. So I was like, okay, I've been the constant because I'm healthy and I have the capacity to do that and I'm determined. So the charity has grown from what was a membership model to a free model. So it's a community rather than membership. So from 400 to now up to like 20 or 30,000 in terms of that reach, but still a drop in the ocean compared to what needs to be connected and supported. So either being the chair or the vice chair for the last 3.5 years, I feel it's important that there's female representation there. And the previous chair, we've kind of swapped back and forth, and her health and her capacity was a questionable element at times. So we've been able to help each other out over the years. She's stepped away now, but still helps. Alana Darcy, who was equally responsible for the rapid growth to the charity being in the place that it's in now. So I think we're at about 25 in terms of volunteers, subcommittees, and we're still all volunteers. So a lot of work has been done to grow what was a very small niche space to a much larger charity that's making an impact.
And I know you aren't going to be passing the baton on to a female doctor.
Yeah, absolutely. Louise Fitzgerald, who did the opening address at the conference. It's important that men are lending their voice as well, so I'm not going anywhere, but it's also important to have fresh ideas and fresh perspectives. I'm 3.5 years, so I've done my time, but it's not to say I'm not going to lose the passion for doing wild challenges, which we'll get to in terms of raising the awareness and having those conversations in corners where they may not have ordinarily been in, you know.
Yeah, and you'll be stepping aside as chair, but you'll be still involved.
Oh, absolutely.
And you mentioned your challenge. So running in jeans is your thing.
Yeah, I have the jeans on. So I've got a partnership here. I did the Dublin Marathon probably a little bit hastily. I didn't fully capitalise on it. Got the most amazing support running the marathon in the team in Rain last year. But I didn't really capitalise on that. So I was like, okay, how can I beat that? Well, okay, so there's 2 super regional centres in the country that deal with complex endo, one in Dublin and one in Cork. So that's in Talla and in Cork Maternity Hospital. So the goal is to run from Dublin to Cork in 2 days. It's 260 kilometres and to run in jeans. I'll have a couple of pairs of jeans at that stage. So I've got some nice partnerships and sponsors on board to support, all the while trying to, you know, spark a conversation. What's this lunatic at? But also it's, as I said, accessibility. It's going to be about endo and I can start a conversation with other people, and hopefully closer to the time we'll be talking more about it and more people will be drawn to asking questions to the why. I'll be asking myself the why. I still don't have my toenails back from last year. So yeah, there's that.
Yeah. And I mean, it is going to be uncomfortable, but I suppose that highlights the discomfort that absolutely women with endometriosis are pushing through every single day. So for people listening, how can we support Endo Ireland? Obviously, sponsor you know, get involved, raise awareness, start talking. What's the message you want to get to people?
It starts with, I suppose, basic empathy and just trying to, you know, understand, because it's from the outside, quite a lot of the time, a lot of the women I speak with, we have a care line as well, which we try and help, you know, women navigate the system. But what we really want to get to is a place of just understanding that what's not visible doesn't necessarily mean that there's so many other things going on under the surface. So just empathy and understanding. And that's, you know, that's subtle. You know, people may withdraw So picking up on those subtleties, a lot of the time young girls are missing from occasions, and that can be the start of the journey, essentially. So we just need to be cognizant of that, just that, and that that responsibility sits with us in terms of that awareness place. And I think we can sometimes be in an echo chamber wanting to fix the system, but we still have a long way to go in terms of awareness. Awareness and support and empathy, and that's the starting point. And I think that's what I can bring to it as a man, is just keep on talking about that in that respect.
So where can people find out more?
We have our socials as probably our most active space. So there's a lot of resource there. That's Endo Ireland. So that's one aspect. I have a social channel as well, specifically for the run, which is the Dublin to Cork run. There's many people that have that up there, so that's on our socials. But we also run a care line as well. So if people are actually, you know, wanting to find out more about, maybe they're going through the journey or they have some concerns, we can support them on that as well. And that's info@endometriosis.ie, and that can be looked after and channeled through there.
Well, Damien, maybe you'll speak to us halfway between Dublin and Cork.
Absolutely.
In the jeans.
Absolutely.
So we'll rouse you on and raise more awareness and more funds. But thank you for what you do. Thank you for coming on. And something I took that was so positive from the conference was a Greek doctor who does a lot of endo surgery and has a lot of Irish women travelling over.
Yeah.
And he said, although, of course, medical tourism has its challenges, he finds women from Ireland are more informed about endometriosis than the Greek women, where there is surgery more readily available. And that was very positive.
Yeah.
Damien, thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, Sarah Colgan is the founder of Project All Rise and a Social Entrepreneurs Ireland awardee. She brings over 15 years' experience in strategic communications, partnerships and social impact across roles at MTV, the BBC and RTE, and is co-founder of Irish content agency Along Came a Spider. Her most recent initiative, 20 by 20, became a national movement for gender equity in sport, increasing participation rates, attendance and media coverage for women in sport. She's now launched Project All Rise to bridge the gap between our education system and neurodivergence, and she joins me in studio now. Sarah, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with 20 by 20. As I said, it had a massive impact. Where did the idea come from?
So yeah, 20 by 20 was inspired by my little girl, who is a teenager now, and really looking at catching myself in a moment of thinking, you know, it was more important for her brother to do sport than her, and then not being able to believe that I'd had the thought. And so the 20 by 20 tagline was, if she can't see it, she can't be it. And that ended up increasing our participation rates, attendances, media coverage, as you said, but changing our cultural perception of girls and women in sport to being something strong and enabled. And so Project All Rise, I suppose, has come from that same idea. In looking at the will is there in terms of, you know, we have such new understanding of how we all think and learn and process differently. But the cultural infrastructure isn't there yet. And so I suppose I want to bring my experience as a film and television producer and across partnerships and communications to package this new learning and to make it accessible to everybody. We're starting with educators, but actually this is for all of society.
Yeah, and this really excites me. Social change is something I feel so passionate about, and the power of even a conversation or a statement or a mindset shift can really move mountains. And that's what you've found, obviously, with 20 by 20. And this is a much needed area. Before we get into Project All Rise, can I ask you about the terminology? My son has dyslexia and ADHD. I'm working with the ADHD coach, Aoife Hughes. She sort of schooled me, as it were, in a very lovely, positive way about how we are all neurodiverse, we have neurodiversity, but then there's neurodivergence and neurotypical. So you've chosen to go with the umbrella term neurodiversity. Was that intentional?
Yeah, so neurodiversity is basically, we are all in society, we are all neurodiverse. You can't have one person who is neurodiverse, because to be diverse, we need other things to be diverse from. So I think that's probably, but I agree that the terminology is really important. So yes, neurodivergent, neurodistinct, neurominority, these are all words for if you are Well, the first thing to say is neurotypical often tends to be used as a word as the counterpoint. But the truth is there is no normal brain. So that, you know, there are differences in all of our brains. And we, when we used to talk about neurodiversity, we used to kind of think about it on along a line, you know, when there was, you were going from one end to the other. Now that has totally been thrown out. And it's more like if you can imagine a colour wheel and we're all at different points on that. And so being neurodivergent and also that can be autistic, ADHD, dyslexia, dyspraxia, OCD, whatever it is, means that you are diverging from, if you think of that kind of the middle hump of typical or more average or more common ways of thinking or learning or processing, that's neurodivergent. So I do think language is huge in this. If we're wanting to progress this and bring that culture change and bring this new perception, also, the word diagnosis is something that's what we associate with a disease, with something that's bad. So that language is now being moved on. So rather than being diagnosed, you're identified, and there's an increase in identifications of different thinkers, learners, and processors. The same with the word interventions. We're not intervening; we're supporting, also. And this is, you know, the autistic community have said this many times, a person is autistic, they're not a person with autism or even worse with ASD. That whole disorder deficit framing, that's all kind of, you know, when you or I would have been at school, that would have been what was, you know, when you know better, you do better. And I suppose Project All Rise has been inspired by the huge advance in our understanding across neuroscience and neurobiology around different ways of thinking, learning, and processing. So yeah, it's about making that now, bringing that into culture.
Yeah, and you're so right. Language is so important, and those distinctions do make a massive difference. And then I also believe there's diversity even within that. So for some people, they want to say, no, my ADHD does not define me. It's just a part of me. Whereas somebody else wants to say, no, that's how I identify. That is who I am. So there's difference and nuance within it all, isn't it?
100%.
So everybody is individual and unique. And I think as we move into this new era where we're recognizing this more, talking about it more than when I was at school, certainly my parents' generation, it wasn't thought about. I think sometimes there can be fear in people that they're going to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing. And I think clarity is often needed.
100%. So I think now that we have, in terms of autistic identifications, they've gone up 800% or something in Scotland over in a 10-year period. It is completely different now. 53% of Gen Z, this is over in the States, identify as definitely or somewhat neurodivergent. And we just did a piece of research with BNA where we just found that 16 to 24-year-olds are four times more likely to identify as neurodivergent than over 54s. So it's a completely different landscape. This is all of our children, our friends' children, our friend circle. And so what's exciting now is I suppose we've got awareness down, we're doing well with that. But we need to move now to the next stage, which is not actually even acceptance. We're kind of in the midst of acceptance, and Project All Rise is about enablement. How do we enable these different ways of thinking, learning, processing, and experience in the world?
So looking into the campaign, is there a focus on teachers and educators that will, of course, in turn impact the students? Because is that who you're looking to help and support? Because also in your fairly shocking statistics, only 10% of educators feel they're equipped to support and enable.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, educators are doing, they're actually ahead of the curve on this, much more so, let's say, than general society. And they are carrying a huge amount. And what is happening is because we have this new understanding, recognition rates are rising and rising, and educators are getting report after report landing on desks, and our health system is completely overwhelmed. It's one thing about identification, but then any kind of follow-on supports afterwards, you know, there is huge pressure on waiting lists and public and private. So that means that our educators are carrying a huge amount with so many different learner profiles across classrooms. And so that's why Project All Rise has decided to start to answer their asks for more support. But it will move across families and young people and workplaces and adults.
Yeah, because I did a course. It was offered free, which I thought was excellent. It was a government initiative. And it was around understanding dyslexia. And one of the things that just really stood out to me was that when you're training to be a teacher, you're not given the skills to identify somebody with dyslexia or how to support them. And that just really stunned me, because not only is that not serving the people in the classroom, that's not serving the teachers and educators either. And I certainly felt that as a parent as well, with, you know, battles that would be being had over reading and getting through homework. And until you have an understanding of how somebody learns, you can't support them.
Yeah, I think up to this point, what has happened is we have tended to treat things as kind of separate packages. So we've done this is the ADHD course, this is the dyslexia course, this is the autism course, et cetera, et cetera. Where really, if we're going to move forward with the fact that, and also co-occurrence is the rule rather than the exception. So a child with one thing will almost inevitably, it would be much more likely for them then to have two or more things as well. So, and these can kind of, you know, an autistic child can sometimes have different needs to an ADHD child, but an ADHD child then sometimes has those competing. So I think what's actually key now is, rather than looking at, okay, separate trainings for this, that and the other, is how can we universally design our classrooms? And it's the same idea as with architecture. So, you know, you dipped the curb and that was to enable wheelchair users, and then it also ended at enabling buggies and skateboards and deliveries and all the rest. Universal design for learning is looking at how we set our classrooms up to expect variability. And there's a huge difference between accommodating something, which is when really, and this is valid across all of society, across our public spaces, across workplaces, across communities and everything. But there's a big difference between accommodating something when really what you feel is that the normal, and I'm using kind of air quotes for that, the normal way is the status quo, versus enabling something by expecting there to be different needs and people using that space. And so that, I think, is really important. And that's where Project All Rise, I mean, where we're starting actually is probably, and Claire, I know that this is part of, you know, you'll probably be interested in this topic or this slant of it, is there's one key word, and it is I think so much of what we've been doing to date has been misguided, probably by the word neuro being in neurodiversity or neurodivergence, is that we have been very cognitively focused. So we are looking or approaching a lot of our strategies and things around the brain, where this is an embodied experience. We are never just a brain. We are always a brain and a body. And so I think the key learning on this is around how we need to start to angle our approaches towards our nervous systems. And that is the most important enabler for neurodiversity, is it's this word called regulation. And I'm sure you'll have come across it and whatever. But when you or I would have been in school, being dysregulated, I mean, now across Gen Z and stuff, that's a common word. But being regulated and dysregulated is really what this is all about. And what Project All Rise is wanting to do is make this kind of instinctive, make this common practice. What is dysregulation? What is co-regulation? What does it mean? What is self-regulation, and how do we do that? And so, yes, that's the kind of the theme, I suppose, for chapter one.
There are literally fireworks going off in my brain. I love this. This is so important and so not talked about. And, you know, I say we've got mind, body and soul, and for anybody to truly thrive, you want all of that to be working as best it possibly can. And you're right, if we're only going neuro and cognitive, then we're not serving. And I love also what you said, which also I learned at that same course that really blew my mind, that if we were to adapt the education system to cater for everyone. At the moment, we're catering for, let's use the labels that we have, neurotypical. And if we expanded that to take in neurodivergent, it would benefit all. Whereas at the moment, it's only benefiting one way of learning. And that really made me think, because as you said, it sounds like we're making accommodations and, you know, we're trying to do things that actually will benefit everybody, not just one cohort. In the same way, as you mentioned, bringing in a ramp will allow for people on skateboards, you know, parents with buggies, delivery people coming up with heavy boxes, not just the people in the wheelchair who, of course, deserve the ramp in the first place. So I think all of that is so, so important. So that was well worth repeating. So you're doing this by a series of videos because you were conscious as well of not adding to educators' workload. We're trying to keep everybody as regulated as possible.
Yeah, 100%. And actually, I will jump in there just to say, I do believe that our educators are actually much more ahead of where we are as a society on this. So our educators are in classrooms with all of these different needs. And there is a huge jump in terms of how we approach them and understand what we're in a system, though, which is, you know, we have a health system which is completely overwhelmed and an education system which, yes, traditionally has been set up for a certain way of expressing our knowledge, of taking in information. And so now the setup of our classrooms, you know, we can include calm corners, we can include options for movement, and it's going to be different in every school. It's going to be different at each age group. This is something that we can bring across society. And looking at, you know, now when we start thinking of in terms of our body's need to, so we'll all recognize, you know, in order to when I'm on the phone, I might pace up and down, or the leg might be going under the desk, or you're clicking your pen because you know the idea of sitting still in a meeting, let's say an hour long meeting, for some people can, you know, just to get your body to stay still can actually be very uncomfortable. For other people, it's easy breezy. That's an hour, that doesn't matter. So having opportunities, I suppose, and options to be able to move when we're needing to focus on a task, or being able to, I think as well, there's probably some, there's like a moral shame or judgment in some executive functioning things. So forgetting things, being organized, you know, whatever. We feel, oh God, you know, yes, some of us will forget things, and you know, this is what reminders are for, and calendars and all these different apps, or not being perfectly organized, or having a desk that looks chaotic, but actually for that person, they know exactly where everything is on that desk and how to function. The same with you know, big loud spaces, or things that are unexpected. So you might have a colleague who's amazing at kind of going into deep work, but quickly, you know, chopping and changing between different things. Again, it's those transitions. We will all have different ways of doing something. And so the big loud spaces I mentioned, having an option there, again, of somewhere quiet to be able to escape to as standard. And that when things are too overwhelming, and this is less seen in adults, because as adults we learn to be able to manage or control or mask, but that's less easy in children. So you'll see a toddler, for example, melting down in a supermarket much more often. But this can happen with you know, teenagers and adults as well. So not having that judgment about the fact that the environment was just too much for this person. Not having judgment around, so one of the big things across this chapter that we're talking about is stimming. And stimming is kind of a word that's not in the, you know, it's not commonly known. But stimming is a way of moving our, we can stim vocally, or it can be movement based. When we're excited, when we're anxious, when we're overwhelmed, when we're distressed. And some of those stims, like bouncing your leg under the table or clicking a pen or something, they're kind of, and again, using air quotes, socially acceptable stims. And so they tend to be less hidden. But things like rocking, vocally stimming, hand flapping and things, they are just as important, and they can show excitement, they can show whatever the thing is, and we need to get used to seeing those in public spaces. We need to get used to seeing those across workplaces. We need to get, you know, so that kids don't feel in school. That's what enables them to be able to take in the information, or to be able to stay within the class. So these are all ways that our body is telling us there are natural signals from our body of this is how I need to move to regulate myself, my energy, to match the energy being asked of me in this space.
Yeah, and I just don't think that we have put two and two together. So somebody who might click a pen or, you know, shake their leg under the table would be labelled a fidget, whereas somebody who has a, air quotes again, less socially acceptable stim, it's seen more as part of a disability that they have. Yeah. Whereas now, with your campaign, we're attaching it to this person is regulating themselves.
Yeah, it's just
this
movement.
Is what they need to feel good within themselves. And that allowance and that acceptance and that understanding, because we didn't go there, because we didn't ask the questions or give the information, we didn't have the understanding. And I suppose that's what you're looking to do. So with the videos, are you taking into consideration how we all learn now? Nobody necessarily wants to hear, and no matter how on board this educator is, it's another course to do and you're going to sit and take in reams of information. Perhaps that's not how they learn either, that we're all looking at our phones, and sometimes a video representation can really be hugely effective on how we learn and take in information.
100%. So that's part of it, is that, you know, this again, educators are carrying so much. This cannot be another thing on their list. This needs to feel accessible. It needs to feel like we're hearing stories. It needs to not have extra paperwork, and none of the Project All Rise course has, you know, any extra administrative kind of burden. It needs to be quick, all under 10 minutes. But also, you know, we were using the example there of stimming. You and I know when we start seeing that a few times, it doesn't become, it just becomes usual. We need to usualize these things. So a key part, it's great to have it in video format, but it's also really important to hear Project All Rise is not about learning about neurodiversity from the outside. It is about feeling it from the inside by hearing stories from neurodivergent young people and adults about what the school day or whatever it is feels like in their body. That's a different type of learning. It's like you say, the difference, you know, watching a 3-minute video versus reading 3 chapters of a textbook. To learn about this and to feel confident that we know it is when you feel like, oh, I met someone last week and they were telling me about that. So when you hear these stories, I think it brings those penny drop moments that much faster.
And you seem quite optimistic and hopeful about the education system. I mean, look, I'm sure you're aware we've a long way to go. But while I think we've come such a long way, as I've already said, from my school generation and the generations before, I still hear from other families, even not just from my own personal experience, that the supports just aren't there. The resources aren't there. The supports aren't there, which isn't serving the educators either. And that often, even with schemes like DARE, where there's a different point system in, you know, in the state exams, that you have to come under a certain threshold to be able to access, you know, the use of a scribe, you know, the use of assisted technology, so that if you don't reach that certain quadrant, that you're not going to access those supports. And I think those barriers need to come down.
I couldn't agree more. That I'm not saying that the system is all set up for neurodiversity and we're good to go. I suppose over the last 2 years, I've been meeting with principals and educators and ANAs, and individually, in terms of what individually they're doing and carrying, it is incredible. But no, the system is, it is not serving different thinkers and learners and processors, and the resources are not there. It is a huge challenge and overhaul that's needed. And one of the things, you know, we're talking about this topic of regulation. One of the words, and I don't know if you've come across it, is co-regulation, and how important that is. It's probably the most foundational thing in terms of particularly for neurodiversity. The National Council for Special Education have brought out a new course, which is called Relate, which is totally, Claire, you'll remember at school, again, when somebody was dysregulated, didn't call it dysregulation. We called it behaviour of, you know, of some description. And that could come out as withdrawal. It could come out in saying no to something. It could come out in anger or whatever. Now, and this is really crucial for this Relate course, is that we're understanding that this is a nervous system response. This is a mismatch with our environment. This is a communication that something isn't okay. the early films from Project All Rise are looking at, it's a tricky, you know, it sounds scientific, co-regulation, but looking at the difference. You know that if you walk into a meeting or someone and everyone starts looking down at their phones, or, you know, you immediately start, you're starting to feel dysregulated. If you are even at home having a fight with your husband or your partner or a friend or a child, whatever, it, how someone is with you, how to know that someone is present when you are feeling overwhelmed or dysregulated and or whatever it is just knowing I'm here, I'm with you, I'm not trying to make it stop. I'm not trying to cognitively reason with you as to why you shouldn't be reacting like this. And so one of the things that I'm really keen to make accessible in this first term is examples and scripts and what it actually looks like to co-regulate with someone. And the difference that this can have for all of our relationships across all our kids, partners, everything is a huge.
And as you said, there's a huge overhaul needs to take place, but it's like a jigsaw. And what an important piece that is, what a central piece that is of the fuller picture. And look, you're only getting going. And I go back to what I said to you at the start with 20 by 20. Yes, we look at this mammoth task, such as equity in sport or the education system and neurodivergence, neurodiversity, but it's one step at a time. And the power of us all being on board and all learning and all understanding can be absolutely massive. So I really applaud what you're doing. I thank you as a parent and as a member of society, and you have my backing all the way. So let's continue to talk as your, you know, terms go on and your information gets out there. Let's keep this conversation going. Where can people find out more, Sarah?
They can find out more on projectallrise.com or on Instagram at projectallrise, which we've only just started. I think we've got two posts, or LinkedIn.
Love it. Sarah Colgan, founder of Project All Rise, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aoife Breen, and to Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound, and Rory Galvin was on podcasts. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.